right? We're going to be in Colossians chapter 3 this morning. If you have a Bible, please turn there with me. And just as you do that, I'll just kind of fill you in on kind of where we're going. So this is our last Sunday before Advent. So if you are familiar with sort of the celebration of Advent, many churches like us will take 4 Sundays leading up to Christmas. Hard to believe there's only 4 Sundays now. And we'll spend time thinking together of what Christmas means and the implications of God sending his son. And so we're going to do that beginning next Sunday, which means that we will not be in Colossians. And then normally we would come back to a series in January and finish up Colossians. But I got the bright idea of doing something a little bit different. It's we're going to come back to Colossians, but we're going to come back after Easter, I think it is, which means from January till Easter, we're going to walk through the life of Elijah. And it's in 1 and 2 Kings. It's a phenomenal story, not because Elijah is the hero, it's because God is the hero. And so we're going to walk through his story and see how God works in his life. And I think there's a ton that we need to consider coming out of it. So that's the plan. So we will be coming back to Colossians in the spring, when winter is just a distant memory, which is going to be lovely. And when we do, we're actually going to come back to this exact passage. So I'm actually going to preach Colossians 3, 1 to 4 twice. Partly because we're going to need the refresher, but partly because there's basically two aspects to it. And so I'm going to leave some things kind of left out this morning, or maybe just mention them briefly, that I'm going to come back to in the spring when we unpack it a second time. But Colossians 3, 1 to 4, I kind of almost view it as a hinge of this book. So if you've ever read or studied much of what Paul writes, so the author that God uses to write this letter and many of the letters of the New Testament, he has a fairly typical way of writing where he will sort of front load his letters with kind of the content about who God is, who Jesus is, sort of what we might call like the theology of his understanding, his belief. And then on the second half, he will kind of deal with how does that theology apply? Like, what difference does that make in life? So even if you were to go through Colossians, you would see there is kind of that. Now, I hesitate to make too much of a distinction, because all of it, of course, is integrated. You can't just cut it into two neat halves quite like that. But there definitely is something to that, where you're going to see, whether it be Romans or Philippians, where you kind of see he front loads the theology. Who's Jesus? What has he done? What difference does that make? And so this passage is kind of a little bit of both. It leans back into who is Jesus and what has he done? And then it kind of starts to also anticipate, and therefore, how ought we to live? Or what difference does that kind of belief make in life? And we want to make sure we really unpack this well, because it is a very important little part of this letter. And to do it, I need to give you a crash course in a couple pieces of ancient Roman/Greek history, so that we read it with the right lenses, because there is a worldview that is very, very foreign to us. Although there's going to be some parts of it, as I unpack it quickly, where you'll kind of go, well, we kind of get it. There's elements of that still going on today. It's just the 2,000 year ago version is so much more extreme than what I think we understand. And so when we read Colossians or some of these other letters that Paul writes, we miss that he's kind of pounding into some cultural views around him to make sure that the shock of who Jesus is fully felt. Like, we need to make sure we get that as we unpack it. So what are the two things? Firstly, and quickly, if we were to go all the way back to, Greek philosophers, and, you know, whether it be Aristotle or, you know, a few of these other, you know, Plato would probably be one of the most prominent names. Anyone heard of Plato? Not the stuff you played with and ate as a child, but the guy. Okay, so one of his main concepts that he talked about quite a bit, and he had different language, so if you read various stuff that he wrote, he describes it in different terminology. But the basic idea is there are two types of people in the world. He wouldn't have put it that way, but there are two kind of approaches to life. One group of people are thinkers. And you would almost kind of view it as like they live from the neck up. They think, there's rational, you're not emotional, you're steady, you're stable. And then the other group of people live from the neck down, impulsive, heart, feeling, emotional. He would actually describe it more in terms of like living by your stomach. Now, granted, it's 2,000 years. Living controlled by your appetites. Now, you might be able to guess, if you've ever read any of Greek philosophers, who the good guys are and who the bad guys are, right? You do not want to be controlled by your appetites, by your stomach, by your emotion, by impulse. Like, they would have viewed that as chaotic, and that is to be rejected and set aside. You want to be controlled by your mind and by your thinking and be very steady and rational and all these kind of things. There's actually, if you go back and read ancient history, it's actually kind of disturbing when you see this played out. There's a letter, quite a famous one, it's a husband writing his wife a letter upon the death of their child. Which is like, even the fact that he's writing her a letter, sort of like, wow, this doesn't seem right. But he's writing her a letter, and the letter is instructing her to not show any grief. Right? Because to show grief is to show emotion. It's to show, you know, possibly you're up and you're down. And so we need to be steady and unmoving and just sort of stable. And the whole thing is he wants to protect his reputation. He does not want to ever be seen as a man who would not be living from the neck up. Right? And so through the ancient world, there's this, on the one hand, there's this lens that says there's a right way to live and a wrong way to live. Now, bearing in mind that if you are poor and you're just struggling to get by and you don't have enough for dinner every night, you could kind of guess where you're living, right? It's hard to ignore hunger pains. You are controlled by your appetites, which leads us to the second big distinction. The second big distinction has to do with rank and status. They are two different things in the ancient world. We probably tend to kind of blend them together. So on the one hand, in the ancient world, there's this thing that we would kind of label rank. In other words, there's sort of I keep wanting to use the word status because we kind of blend them together. You have a position in life, and your position in life is based upon typically your family. So your parents and their parents and their parents before them, if you have the right name and the right background, you have rank. If you don't, well, sorry, tough luck. You're out of luck. That's the one side of it. So again, going back to the ancient world, there's lots of occasions where if you're signing like legal documents, oftentimes you not only have to sort of sign your signature and indicate who you are, but then you have to indicate 8 generations of your family. Can you imagine that? On wedding licenses today, like if you get married, there's like all the stuff you fill out, and then there's a part where the bride and groom have to actually give the name, full names of their parents and their birthplaces. And it's a tip. You guys will need this information just, you know, coming up here pretty quick. And it's funny to me how many times we get to that point, like usually we do it at the rehearsal, so it's done ahead of time. And like, you know, here's bride and groom. It's like, oh, I don't know my mom's middle name. Well, that's all right. I don't know where my dad was born. It was like somewhere in the prairies, you know, that kind of thing, right? One generation is like, we don't know this. Can you imagine having to know, in order to sign a legal document, 8 generations, names, birthplaces, occupations, birth dates, all this kind of information, because it was so important to establish your rank within society and to never lose it. And so that proved your rank, okay? So that's one side of it. The other side is a thing that they would kind of refer to more as status. And status has to do more with the things that we might look to. It's like your education, your financial situation, your prominence or fame, right? Those kind of things, which may or may not correspond with rank. This is where it starts to get really kind of tricky and a little bit kind of messy, because you could have theoretically high rank. You come from a very influential family, very prominent. But maybe they've fallen on hard times and they've lost their financial wealth. And so status-wise, they're down here, but rank-wise, they're up here. Or you could flip it around and you could sort of be in a situation where, you know, you've got someone who's got very, very high status. They've made it big, very, very wealthy. In fact, there's lots of cases in the ancient world of slaves, and it sounds funny to us because we don't think of it like this, but slaves who became very, very wealthy people. Because they were slaves, say, of prominent people, and they used their position to amass a lot of personal wealth. And yet, rank-wise, they are the lowest of the low, right? You are a slave. You're essentially nothing. And it's very, very hard to move up and down rank, right? It can be done, but it's going to take generations. It's not like you could just, in one generation, hit it big, start a high-tech company, and now you've got all this money, and now your rank moves up. It's like, typically, the way it would work is like, we'll watch. Like, we'll get back to you in 5 generations and let you know if you've started to move up the rank. And so you get this weird thing going on in the ancient world. Now, if you had rank, it was incredibly important to make sure that you portrayed power and influence and dignity. And you start to see where all this stuff meshes of these two pieces of life. So you're trying to make sure you're steady and you're thoughtful and you never show emotion, right? But you want to make sure you show power and influence. So a person of rank would never work, right? Because you're way too important to actually dirty your hands. Instead, what you do is you give away your money, right? You pay to have roads paved because there's not like taxes and like city works, right? So you as an individual, you are giving away, and then they build you a statue, right, in a town. It's like, hey, Don built us a new amphitheater. He's an awesome guy. Like that's sort of this whole patronage thing. So you're trying to build your rank and your prominence by spending your money, not by working. Now, all of this becomes really important because if you kind of put all these pieces together and then start to think through just some of the basic fundamental concepts of what we know about Jesus, take, for example, Philippians chapter 2. Paul says, you know, he is God. There is no higher rank than that. And in the Roman and Greek worlds, like, you would never let go of that rank. There is nothing on earth that would ever lead you to let go. But he emptied himself. I mean, it's almost scandalous what Paul is suggesting. He emptied himself, took on the likeness of human flesh, was born, and then died on a cross, which is the death of a slave. And when we read that, I'm sure it impacts us. We're like, wow, Jesus did that for me? It's like, yes, but start to think of the historical backdrop of there would not be a person on the planet in their world who would ever have conceived of doing that. To let go of power and rank and empty yourself and becoming a servant, to die on a cross. Now, all through Colossians, Paul has been bumping into this. We just don't tend to see it. Let me just give you just one example of a moment where I think it shows up back in chapter 1, where Paul says this, "May you be strengthened." So this is his prayer. "May you be strengthened with all power according to his glorious might." This is the language of rank and status. It's like, yes. And again, if you are a Roman or Greek person reading this for the first time, you love the first part of that line. You're sitting there, someone in church comes, because this is how they would do it. They wouldn't have all had copies of it. Someone would have come, they would have opened this letter, started to read it, like, "May you be strengthened with all power and might." I'm like, sign me up for that. Like, that sounds good. And then the letter continues. "For all endurance and patience with joy." It's like, hold on a second. Endurance and patience are the things you need when you're going through suffering and through difficulty. That's not triumph. But I thought we were going to have power and might. And you start to see what Paul is doing. He's blending these concepts together in such a way that these early Christians and people who were hearing this for the first time were having to kind of almost like try to reconstruct a whole worldview, a whole set of lenses. And then you get into the rest of chapter 1, you're reading about Jesus. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, for by him all things are made, and they all exist for him. I mean, this is an incredible statement of the position of Jesus. And then you get a few more verses later, and we start reading about how he makes peace by the blood of his cross. Like, how can the one who is over everything die on a cross? In the height of weakness and folly, how do those things fit? And this is what the early church is trying to wrestle and fit these things together. And we are invited as followers of Jesus into a path of weakness, not strength. Right? Into a path of service, not prominence. And in the ancient world, they're having to wrestle this through. I even think we see a little bit of this in Paul himself. If you remember Paul's story, he is on the fast track to be the most prominent up-and-coming Pharisee in the world. Pharisees did not work with their hands, I will have you know. But if you went to Sunday school, probably somewhere along the line, you were taught, which is very true, and Paul talks about himself, he's a tent maker. And it probably never, there's probably nothing that twigged in your head of like, why is that such a shocking thing? He talks himself about the fact that he had the right. It would have been totally fine for him to have accepted money from the church so that he could have continued on his ministry, but he didn't. He refused. He became a tent maker. That's a man of rank. Could have been a Pharisee. Could have said, no, I'm above that. I'll be a leader in the church, but I'm not letting go of my position. And instead, he becomes a guy who's working with his hands in a very, very blue-collar job. And you start to realize that maybe what he's doing, maybe it's more than just he needed a job to make a bit of money. Maybe he is actually trying to live out and model something in his faith, his understanding of his rejection of one world because of his belief and confidence in who Jesus is and who Jesus declares him to be. And this all comes back to this question that chapter 3, verse 1 to 4 is going to wrestle with of who you are. What is your rank? What is your status? Where do you fit? And I think what Paul wants us to see is we fit where we fit, not because of where we were born, the riches we amassed, or any of those kind of things. It all comes down to who we are in Christ Jesus and the identity we have because of who he is and what he's accomplished for us. And here's what he writes. If, actually it's better since, because it's not that he's asking a question here in chapter 3, verse 1. It is the implication of what he has told us to be true back in chapter 1 and 2. Since you have been raised with Christ. Right, we sang of resurrection, right? Remember, that song based in the Apostles' Creed, we believe in the resurrection. Paul does too. For Paul, he believes, yes, that Jesus Christ died and was raised from the dead, but he also believes that he has died and has been raised. Beyond just an analogy or a metaphor or a nice idea, he literally believes that moment that he met Jesus on the Damascus Road was the moment Paul died and rose to life again. I don't know what your moment was, but what I know is if Paul was standing here and had a conversation with you and said, tell me about the moment that you came to understand your sin, the holiness of God, the separation between you and God, and in that desperate moment you realized that there could be forgiveness through Jesus and you cried out to him and you were saved. It's like that moment right there, you died and you have been raised to life again. And so you're no longer your own. You've been bought by a price. Right? This is the logic of what the New Testament teaches us about who we are. So now we are his, and since we are his, and since we've been raised with Christ, we have two specific instructions. There's two imperatives in this verse, or in this little section. Seek the things that are above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on the things that are of the earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God, and when Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. So Paul says, in light of who Jesus is and the fact that we have died, you go back to chapter 2, and Paul's already told us that since you have died, you know, this has happened. You're dead to a whole different way of life. And I get it. Like, if you're sitting in here going, well, I don't feel dead, like, you must feel something different than I feel. I do not feel, we're going to come to that in a moment in this hiddenness piece of what Paul's going to say. I think that's a part of the struggle. We look at this and we just go, well, I don't feel like I've died and I don't feel like I have been raised to eternal life. Like, there's not a subjective moment where I felt that. Someone said, it's like, well, I never even felt like I was sick, right? Let alone died. But Paul's like, no, this is what happened. This is what we understand to be true if we're going to believe God's word. This has happened. So Paul says, now there's two things we need to do. And it's interesting. He goes right to the heart at this Roman way of looking at the world. He says, first, seek the things that are above. And then look what he says in verse 2. Set your minds on things that are above. And he's just said two different things. They're not the same thing. He's not just repeating himself. The first would be more literally like, set your heart on things above. Set your heart on the one who is above. Because he's not just talking about like, hey, pursue the streets of gold and a pearly gate. No, set your heart on Jesus. And then he turns around. The next thing he says is, now set your mind on Jesus. And interesting in that world where Aristotle and Plato are like, no, don't do that. They just be a mind person. Like Paul's like, no, we're going to be all in with our whole being. All of our affections, all of our love, all of our passion, we're going to pursue Jesus. Now, this is sort of an interesting thing as we think this through. It's a continuous present indicative. In other words, Paul is saying, every day you wake up, set your thoughts on Jesus and set your heart on Jesus. Like, don't let a day go by where that doesn't happen. And probably all of us as followers of Jesus need to wrestle through how we do that. There are things that grab us for a season. I used a bad illustration in the first service, but I'll use it again because now you're all curious. It's like, what was so terrible about it? I know. I use the illustration of like a fancy car. Like every once in a while, like particularly in the summer because of where the church is located, and there's not everyone in Predator Ridge. There was some of our Predator Ridge church family were here in the first service, so it worked really, really well as I used this illustration. It's like, people up in Predator Ridge, they all have Ferraris and Lamborghinis. And then someone in first service is like, well, I don't have a Lamborghini. I'm like, well, I don't know what's going on. But sometimes in summer, there are a few that seem to come from up that hill and they drive by the church. And every once in a while, I see one. And I will admit, there's a little bit of my heart, actually, there's quite a bit of my heart that for a brief moment goes, oh, I love that. And who wouldn't? Really, like just like put me behind the wheel just for a little while. That would be pretty spectacular. And then it goes by and I carry on with my day. And my heart is not consumed with that. It's just like a brief moment and then it's gone. I don't think about it. I don't meditate on it. Now, if I was to take car pictures and put them up in my office all around me, you know, plaster a screensaver on my laptop, you know, all that kind of stuff, you could see how I could start to generate a heart that was all into that. If I started a bank account, it's like, this is my Ferrari bank account. We're going to add like $1 a week and I better live for 500 years to be able to one day, right? You could start to see how I could train my heart and my mind to pursue something like that. And Paul's saying, don't live that way. Instead, train your heart and your mind to love Jesus, to understand how great he is and to pursue him and set your heart and set your mind on who he is and understand and meditate on him so that you love him more and more and want to pursue him. This is Paul's instruction to us. There's going to be an implication. This is where we're going to come back to in the spring. When we do this, and this is the context, if you remember last week, he just ended chapter 2 with saying all the rules of saying no to sin are actually impotent to stop sin. Right, so if you're wrestling with sin and saying, I'm trying to stop sin, Paul's argument through the last half of chapter 2 is to say, don't. It probably actually will not help you beat sin. No is a very powerless thing. And so Paul's argument is, but when you fall in love with Jesus and set your mind and heart on him to such a degree that you would know that if I choose sin over Jesus, I'm going to lose Jesus, but I don't want to lose Jesus. So why would I choose sin? You know, if you could kind of compare it to someone who knows, hey, there's this brilliant, we're coming up to Christmas, right? So this brilliant Christmas dinner coming up pretty soon. And there's now sort of like an old stale Bethlehem Star cookie, right? With raisins in it. It's food. It's edible. But it's nothing like the meal. Can you imagine there right before the meal? It's like you sit down like with 16 cookies and just start like shoving your face with raisin bran cookies or something like that. It'll fill you up, but you've ruined. Now your appetite's gone, right, for this incredible meal. That's this dynamic when it comes to sin. When we understand Jesus is this incredible meal that will satisfy us, sin is a bran cookie. Oh, there's... Or whatever, you might like bran cookies, I don't know. Fill in the gap, whatever it is, right? It's the cookie you don't really like, but you ate because you're really hungry and that was all that was left. There is some pleasure. Let's not kid ourselves. That's why we sin. But it's such an inferior pleasure to the pleasure of having our hearts and minds set on the glory of Jesus. This is Paul's argument, and that's where he's going to go, because you can look at verse 5, right? Put to death, therefore, what is earthly. Like, once you taste Jesus, now you're prepared to put those things to death. Now the things where you say, I don't want to do that, they have power because your affection is set on Jesus. And that's what propels us to be able to defeat sin and turn from it. Because why would I give up Jesus for that? And we'll come back to that in the spring. But for now, let's just kind of keep working our way through what Paul has to say here in these few verses. I don't know about you, but my problem at this point is when I think of what Paul has said, okay, I have been raised with Christ, I have died, and this transformation has happened, a transformation so profound that I could never generate it. Remember this whole issue of rank and status? It's like you can't elevate yourself, but you think of what's happened. If we believe what the New Testament has said, you have been adopted into the family of God. You are now a son or daughter of the living God. There is no higher rank. There's nothing more that you could gain. And so we get this elevation of rank, this transformation where I have died and been raised to life again, and then I look at myself in the mirror and go, sure doesn't seem like it. Look what Paul says next. Your life is hidden with Christ in God. There's two pieces. There's two sides of this. On the one hand, there's a security piece. In the ancient world, again, if you're trying to secure something, there wasn't a bank. You couldn't go to a safety deposit box. The way you secured something and kept something special safe is you hid it. You might bury it. So Jesus talks a number of times, right, about, you know, a guy walking and he discovers something hidden in a field, right? That's kind of the world they're living in. So you have something of value, hide it. And Paul is saying, hey, understand that your life is hidden with Christ in God. I don't think the emphasis at this point is on our value of God, although he is. This is actually the reverse. This is God saying, you as my sons and daughters are so valuable to me that I have in Christ hidden your life. I protect you. I'm going to see you safely home. That's the first piece of it. But there's another side to this. It's this hidden part where when you look at yourself in the mirror, or just for a moment, just subtly look, do you have peripheral vision? Just kind of look out the side of your eyes, right? Right? You're looking at people who are sons and daughters of the living God, who are eternally alive. And yet we don't seem it. We don't appear it. It's hidden. I think this is Paul's point. Don't let the hiddenness of this cause you to despair or give up. Look what he says next after this hidden. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Then what you are will be seen. Right now, there's a little bit of glory in this room. Some of you look really good this morning. But you think of what Paul's saying is one day Christ will return. And now notice what he's not saying. He's not saying that the glory is like a place. Like we misread what Paul's saying if we think what Paul is saying is heaven is called glory and glory is just another word for heaven. That's not what he's after. He's not saying that it's like a setting, like maybe a big stadium and the stadium is the glory. No, he's not even saying that we are like the spectators in a stadium giving glory to Jesus. He's actually saying that somehow when Christ appears, we are pulled into his glory. Like, I mean, I don't think you're going to find English language that does this really justice. And it almost, there's moments where you just think, man, it feels like we're coming right up to almost something that would be heretical. Because Jesus is Jesus and we will never be. It's his glory. But somehow the union we have with him is such a spectacular thing that one day his glory will be in us. That's the point Paul's driving at. And one day, that reality will appear. And right now, it's hidden. Every once in a while, you'll hear a story in the news of, they're usually pretty tragic, stories of, you know, someone who's passed away. Actually, some of them are kind of neat. So stories of people who have passed away who appeared to have nothing. Have you ever read one of these stories in the news? Every once in a while, they pop up. There was actually one, I had the name somewhere tucked. Sorry, I haven't been using my notes here very well, but somewhere down here, I actually had the name of the guy. Here it was. Leroy Walters was his name. And I'm not sure how far back this story is, but he died. He was a homeless man. He lived outside of a senior center in Arizona. And he ate his meals at the hospital cafeteria. They actually fed him at the hospital. And they knew he often would use the phone at the hospital. They didn't really know why, because he never married, had no kids. So they didn't really know of any connections this guy had. But one lady who worked at the senior center out where he slept had befriended him. And when he died, kind of dug into his story. He left his part of his estate to the National Public Broadcasters because he loved to listen to radio. So that part of his estate got the first $4 million. He owned no home. He slept outside. He had no vehicle. He had been an engineer, and at one point, he just walked away from the whole thing. And when he was on the phone at the hospital, it turns out that's where he was doing his stock trading. Right? He hadn't lost his capabilities. He just was not interested. And so people looked at him and said, there's a homeless guy. He has nothing. What he was completely obscured. It was hidden. And then it was revealed. And I think that's kind of maybe not a bad comparison to what Paul has in mind. People might look at us. We are a people who ought to say, I'm not going to pursue the things the world values, the rank and status of the world, because I have a new status and a new rank that is made true because of who Jesus is. So now I pursue him and I set my mind and I set my affections on him, and the world looks and goes, that looks crazy. That looks foolish. It looks weak. It looks powerless. And Paul says, but they can't see. It's hidden. But one day it will be revealed. So do not lose heart. Don't abandon the course of setting your affections and your mind on Jesus. But there's another kind of story that's similar to the first story. It's the story that is told from just a few years back, where a man by the name of Timothy Henry Gray, also a homeless man, died under a bridge of hypothermia in Wyoming. Penniless, or so we thought. See, he didn't know that the night he had died under that bridge, people were trying to find him to let him know that he had just inherited $19 million. It's not all about money, right? It's an analogy. Here's a man who thought he had nothing, and by the world standard, had a vast fortune. And I think there's some of us, maybe too many of us, who have underestimated what it means for our lives to be hidden with Christ, what it means for us to have been raised with Christ. We look and we go, that doesn't seem, maybe we would never say it out loud. We look and we, maybe quietly in our own hearts, we just go, man, I'm not sure if that's really all that valuable. And we risk dying under a bridge in Wyoming thinking we're penniless, not understanding the glory that is ours in Christ Jesus. So, Emmanuel, what do? We understand the glory of Jesus. We understand that one day he's going to come back. And Paul says to the Thessalonians, I love how he says it to him. He says, he's going to come back to those who are prepared to marvel at his appearing because he's marvelous. And so we are to set our minds and set our hearts on him. I don't think it's any mistake that he writes this to the least influential nothing church of the whole early church world. The church and the city that had lost its rank and lost its status. Remember way, way back when we started introducing this series back in September, I gave that little crash course on Colossae. It had once been a prominent place, but it had become a nothing place. It's the only place Paul wrote to he didn't visit. It's like the least influential, least significant. It's the nothing church. And yet Paul writes to them and says, your rank is not about that. You've died. You've been raised to life again. You are infinitely, infinitely wealthy in Jesus Christ. So set your minds on him and set your heart on him.